Welcome to the Educause Podcast. This podcast is sponsored by Moran Technology Consulting, providing management and IT consulting services to higher education institutions around the world. MoranTechnology.com. I'm Jerry Bain for Educause, and on this podcast, we feature a presentation from the ELI 2012 conference. The speaker is Chris Deedy, the Timothy E. Wirth Professor in Learning Technologies at Harvard University. His presentation is entitled Transforming Higher Education with Emerging Technologies.
Well, as you might have gathered from the introduction, a lot of my research is design-based. I build things using emerging technologies, put them out into real settings, watch the wheels come off, build them again better, put them out into real settings, watch different wheels come off, and eventually am able to draw some conclusions about whether what we're looking at is the golden goose or the wild goose in terms of learning. So I'm going to do a little bit of an unusual talk today, taking advantage of having ELI for an audience. We're going to do a thought experiment together. So I'm going to describe for you, set a couple years into the future, a middle grades ecosystem science course that's based on four emerging technologies. So this is a trip into the future, if you will, but the near future. Now you're saying to yourselves, wait a minute, this is a higher ed audience. Why is he talking about a middle school course? The thought experiment is, if this is what's happening in middle school, what then should be happening in higher education? And are some of the pedagogies and technologies that I'm going to show you applicable to higher education in your particular field? And what kind of professional development experience would be necessary if faculty were to use the same kinds of teaching approaches that I'm going to show you for the middle school? So the four technologies are immersive virtual environments, social media, augmented reality, and virtual performance assessments. And my research group is working in all of these, and so the grounded example of the middle school science curriculum is because that's what we've been building. So in terms of immersive virtual environments, we have a project called EcoMove. It was funded by the Institute of Education Sciences. It's a one-month curriculum that uses two digital ecosystems that we've constructed. And the purpose is to teach three things at the same time: ecosystem science, collaborative scientific inquiry that includes the front end of inquiry where you're finding out what the problem is, as opposed to what students pre-college usually get, which is the back end of inquiry where you're just doing a canned laboratory of some kind. And then something that's typically not taught much pre-college, which is causal complexity. And ecosystems are a classic example of causal complexity. And what I want to show you is a video about a particular pond that's located near Harvard that's part of the Cambridge school system, and the virtual pond that we created as a part of the curriculum. So this is just a demonstration of the pond.
EcoMove is an exciting new curriculum research project at the Harvard Graduate School of Education that uses immersive virtual environments to teach middle school students about ecosystems and causal patterns. It includes two computer-based modules, Pond and Forest, within a four-week inquiry-based ecosystems curriculum. Here we are in the Pond module. We can walk around the pond and see all the different plants and animals, like these ducks. The camera tool lets us take pictures, and saving the photo displays a virtual field guide with information about each of the organisms we find. We can also walk under the water to see the species living there. And using a virtual microsubmarine, we can also shrink down and see the microscopic life in the pond. The environment includes the land surrounding the pond, including a golf course and a housing development. Following this runoff pipe leads us to a drainage ditch near a new housing development, where we meet a landscaper putting down fertilizer. Throughout the environment, on different days, we meet virtual characters like Manny, who may provide useful information. Back at the pond, the measurement tools let us take various measurements of the water in the pond, such as phosphates and turbidity. Students can collect weather and population data as well. The calendar tool lets us travel through time in order to see how the pond has changed on different days. Here, it's raining. When we walk under the pond, we can see how cloudy the water is. The turbidity is higher. And we can also take another measurement. The data view allows us to see and compare data we've collected. The atom tracker tool allows students to be able to see what happens to the atoms in the ecosystem over time, as if they could find and track specific atoms. On each simulated day, the students should be able to find the atom tracker signs and read a description of what has happened to the atoms since the last visit. Here we see an oxygen atom that is part of a water molecule in the leaf of a tree. And then on the next day, through photosynthesis, the oxygen atom is being released into the air as part of an O2 molecule. As students explore different days at the pond, they discover that on July 28th, all the large fish in the pond are dead. Through the inquiry-based curriculum, students work in teams to collect and analyze data in order to figure out what killed the fish. Once the students have collected all the data, they can use the graphing tool to compare different variables to help them create concept maps to explain why the fish died. Through an exploration of the pond scenario within this immersive simulated environment, students develop a richer understanding of complex causal relationships in ecosystems.
Let me just talk a little bit about this. It could easily be the basis of a talk in itself. This is an immersive, authentic simulation. So this is designed to give students who are sitting inside of a classroom, which in fact is a pretty barren learning environment, as you know, the chance to actually be in the middle of a simulated ecosystem and to behave like ecosystem scientists. But because these are middle school students, we're blending authenticity with a kind of principled magic. So where students have pervasive misconceptions, we're using different kinds of magic to help them overcome them. One of them is how matter flows through the ecosystem. So we have the little Where's Waldo GIS embedded atom that you can track as it moves around the system. Another one is invisible causes, and so they can get into the submarine and shrink down to microscopic size and find things in the pond that they never knew were there. If nothing else, they gain a profound respect for why not to drink pond water. And what we're interested in doing is a couple things that are unusual. One of them is teaching complex causality and seeing how far we can get with that at the middle school. A second is teaching them the front end of inquiry. And here we use a kind of jigsaw pedagogy where the students work in teams of four and each has a different role and they have to pool their data in order to figure out why the fish have died. And this, of course, is really how modern science is done by and large. So we were out in 121 implementations last spring. We're busy analyzing our data. But the most interesting part, I think, is how far the students can get in figuring out for themselves a very complicated causal process that starts the very first day that they're in the ecosystem with Manny fertilizing the lawns on the houses above the pond, and then progresses over a three-week period to the point that the large fish die. So we're excited by the kinds of responses that we're getting from students in terms of engagement, learning ecosystem science, demonstrating inquiry skills, and sorting out this complex causal problem. And, of course, this is a middle school simulation, but based on the kind of results that I'm seeing, I feel that if we were to deepen this and make it a high school simulation with less magic, with a more complicated ecosystems problem, with dynamic simulation engine underlying the virtual environment, that they could do college-level work with supports. So then the question becomes, what do we do in college when we're able to do this pre-college? Social media is part of why the students are able to get as far as they do, well beyond what middle school students ordinarily can do. And I want to make clear that this is not gifted and talented students. We're implementing this in a full range of classrooms, including classrooms where students are typically low performing, have little background in science, and have a science teacher who doesn't really know very much about science. And that isn't to say that it works as well in those settings, but that it works pretty well. So we all are familiar with social media of different kinds. A couple years ago, I wrote an article for Educational Researcher talking about the list of social media at that time. Like you, when I'm teaching, I look at my instructional goals and my students and my content, and I decide which, if any, of these tools are appropriate for my use. And what we find is that the students in the middle school who are doing the eco move, even without being prompted, start using a lot of social media outside of school settings in order to help them figure out what's happening. They interact with their friends. They go out and find stuff on the internet. They engage in a kind of a community of practice to sort out what's going on. And, of course, in doing that, they're building up some of these digital literacies that we're all studying and trying to make sense out of. I enjoy having distributed cognition available to me this time of year when I do my taxes, because I form an intellectual partnership with my tax preparation program. It does what it does well, which is to manipulate numbers accurately and put them on the right line of the form. I do what I do well, which is to make up creative excuses for the IRS, and the two of us together have a kind of distributed cognition that works out pretty well. I watch the middle school students, and they're using transmedia navigation followed by judgment. So they look at all of these sources on the internet. Some are incomplete, many are inconsistent, some are inaccurate, some are biased. They have to try to synthesize all these together and form some kind of opinion about them that's consistent with what they're seeing in the simulated world. I don't believe in all of these new literacies. After decades of faculty meetings, I no longer believe in collective intelligence, for example. But it may be that these media are powerful enough that even that goal can eventually be attained. The third technology is mobile. Some of you may remember 36 years ago, a powerful handheld device for learning, the little professor from Texas Instruments. One of the great tragedies of my life is I now look like the little professor. I never thought I would get this old. And of course, our modern cell phones are much, much more powerful than the little professor was on multiple dimensions. My friends in the hardware industry tell me in the next 10 years we're going to gain as much power on all of those dimensions as we did in the last 36 years. So asking ourselves what we're going to do when not only when every college student has the equivalent of a supercomputer in their pocket, but every student middle school and above does as well. Even students from impoverished families who may not be buying that device for educational purposes, but for whom it can be repurposed. That's a very interesting opportunity. And of course, a lot of what we're doing with that opportunity is putting old wine in new bottles. So being able to access the internet any place, anytime, is old wine. It's also very powerful. But as an emerging technologies person, I think about new wine. And the new wine that I've spent a lot of time thinking about is augmented reality, where your device knows where it is, and it can access things around it that have been augmented. I remember when the Terminator movies came out, and I watched the Terminator, and I was very impressed because it had magic eyes. It could see the world, but on top of the world, it could see all these visualizations and data. Now, the Terminator then did some uncool things, and I kind of lost my affiliation with it. But I remained impressed with the idea of having magic eyes. And, of course, now augmented reality has reached the stage that it can use two different kinds of sensing, location-aware sensing that tells it more or less where it is in the world through GPS, and then vision-based, where you look through the camera recognizes something in what it's seeing and superimposes something else. So, for example, I do a lot of travel, And I dread getting to a situation like this because I have absolutely no idea whatsoever what that sign says, unless, of course, I can hold up my mobile device and the augmented reality capability recognizes what it's seeing and substitutes something that I can understand. So that's the fundamental new wine capability that I want to talk about. So now with funding from the National Science Foundation, EcoMove is morphing to a blended curriculum that complements the virtual environments with augmented realities through different kinds of mobile devices, smartphones, and then the Texas Instruments Inspire, which is like a graphing calculator that has probeware that you can attach to it and do lots of graphing connected with it. And what we're doing is early pilots where we've taken the same pond that we modeled in EcoMove, and now we've put hotspots around it for augmented reality, and we're setting up things that the students can see through their devices, both location-based and vision-based, that provide visualizations, simulations, data, and even highlight things like places to look at animal scat, which can be very useful in doing things like making population estimates. So I want to show you just some very early work from these pilots and have you meet Amy, who is the ecosystem scientist who's helping us with this.
EcoMobile is a program we've been developing for middle school students that helps them to connect with their learning in the classroom with the real-world experience. So they've been able to work in the classroom in their science class with a multi-user virtual environment where they explore a virtual pond and they act like scientists to collect information about an ecological mystery that's happened at the virtual pond. But then now we've developed EcoMobile to allow the students to take some of the pieces that they're learning about in the classroom and learn more about them in the real world. So we've developed an augmented reality game that the students can play on smartphones using a 3G wireless network at a real pond. So as the students move around the real environment, they encounter hotspots. And at the hotspots, there is information that connects with what they were learning in the classroom. Things like what's a producer, a consumer, or a decomposer, or allows them to take measurements of the pond to test its water quality. So the students have been coming out with us to the pond environment and going on field trips and using augmented reality to connect their experiences with the classroom.
Wants to know, what is the most common type of organism you observe?
Honestly,
you've observed a lot of producers.
Because I see a lot of green and all of these plants and trees are producers.
And they are produced, so.
Yeah.
The kids have been very excited to use the smartphone devices, and it's amazing to see how quickly they can pick it up and use it to its full capacity. It took a very short introduction for the kids to be able to navigate with the device and to access these hotspots, and they were figuring things out and troubleshooting together. It was really fun to see them work together to solve some of the problems that they were encountering, and you know, one student might not quite understand how something worked, and another student was right there to help them figure it out. Some of the programs they're using and the probes that they're using are very similar to what real scientists use to monitor ecosystems. And so they're getting experiences that rival what real scientists do. And they realize that. And they see things about the water quality and start to understand what this means for, you know, we've had a lot of rain in the last few days. They're connecting the fact that the rain might affect what's happening in the pond and what's happening in their local environment. So they're starting to understand that the things that happen in the world are affecting things very close to their homes.
The higher, the more cloudy.
The more cloudy, and the lower, the less cloudy.
The less cloudy.
I think it would be 0 to 20.
Yeah,
I agree.
Yeah.
Yes. All right.
That was a good prediction. Now let's see if you were right.
Okay. Could you get the bucket?
Yeah.
Got it?
The line.
Wait, what was our decomposer?
Yeah.
Oh, you're going to need to cap on that.
Did you fill it out?
Yeah, it's filled up to the... Make sure is it lined up.
All right, let's see.
All right.
Now we've got to turn this on. So it's channel 2, so it's the brown one.
Okay.
So
mine is
it's going up.
So if we didn't have these phones, the students wouldn't have a good way to access some of the additional information that connects with the classroom. their experiences in the real world when we've gone on field trips with them before have been these one snapshot kind of activities that when they go back to the classroom, it's really hard to remember what they did or why it mattered. But now that we have the phones to connect their experiences in the classroom with the real world, we can take the phones back to the classroom and use them to help the students connect with their learning in both places.
This is awesome. Yeah. We get to like learn about like the dissolved oxygen in this case, and we're answering the questions that, and we can test the water and it's awesome. It's much better than using a textbook because you're in it. You can see everything instead of just reading, and the questions are related to what you can physically do instead of just what you know from your knowledge. So
when I describe to people what we're doing in the classroom, people think it's so cool. There's a lot of enthusiasm for exploring how these technologies could really benefit student learning.
Well, as you might expect, part of what we're studying is when do you want to use a virtual environment, when do you want to use an augmented reality, how do the two of them interact with one another. We're also looking at augmented reality authoring, because unlike virtual worlds, it can be pretty straightforward to author augmented reality from a technical perspective. The instructional design is complicated. Getting it authentic to real science is complicated. But creating the augmented reality is really not particularly difficult at all. And so I expect within a couple years, not middle school students perhaps, but high school students who've had this kind of work in middle school will be able to start augmenting realities around them in their neighborhoods, in their parks, in lots and lots of places, so that these kinds of augmented reality experiences will be pretty routine. And of course, one of the interesting research questions also is the question of transfer. We all struggle to get transfer out of the classroom environment. The virtual environments are a step closer to the real world, so a little closer to near transfer. Augmented reality is a step closer still, and it will be interesting to see what kind of transfer results we can get. So, For millennia, we have been saying, if you want to learn, get away from the world. Come to the forum with Socrates, because the world is confusing. It's chaotic. It's noisy. Come to the medieval campus. Come to the industrial era school. Get inside of a classroom and have the opportunity away from the world for interpretation and reflection. And there's much to be said for that point of view. There's much to be said for getting away from the world for interpretation and reflection. But now, I think a lot of people are getting excited about the fact that we might be able to complement that with someone standing right in the middle of the world, crazy and noisy and chaotic, with a device that knows who they are and how they like to learn, where they are, and what around them has been augmented for learning, and who they like to learn with, and how to reach them. That's a very intriguing vision, and I think we're just on the edges of beginning to understand what its strengths and limits are, and what entering students might be like if they got to college, having had a lot of experience with immersive, authentic simulations, both virtual and augmented, that were in disciplinary fields of different kinds, not just science, but augmenting malls for economics, augmenting cemeteries and neighborhoods for history, and so on. The fourth technology deals with assessment. And I was at the analytics session yesterday, and I don't want to get into analytics particularly as a hot topic, So I would say that what we're doing is assessment that has some dimensions of analytics connected with it, but it's really different than what people were talking about yesterday. So one problem with these kinds of curricula that I'm describing in the middle school is that if you take students who've done these very rich inquiry experiences and you contrast them with a classroom that's done nothing but reading and listening to lectures, and the instrument that you use to measure learning is a paper and pencil item-based test, the two classrooms are going to look pretty similar because the paper and pencil test is incapable of measuring most of the interesting and important kinds of things that the students are learning that go beyond simple recall and being able to recognize the right answer when it's surrounded by distractors of different kinds. So using, again, this sort of Alice in Wonderland interface for virtual environments, we have been studying whether or not we could build a virtual performance assessment that was capable of measuring science inquiry. And we picked inquiry for a number of reasons. First, it is a classic 21st century skill. Making meaning out of complexity is fundamental to modern life, whether it's historical inquiry, scientific inquiry, there's lots of flavors here. And second, this has been very well studied by cognitive scientists, and so we have an excellent sense of what the subskills are and how they interrelate to one another and how some of them might be measured. So what we've been building is a summative assessment, the kind of thing that you might give to a student at the end of a year in middle school to understand what they have and haven't learned about inquiry. I'll explain later that that isn't really what I want to have a couple years from now, but it's where we are at the moment. And I'm going to show you just a portion of a video that describes what this might look like.
Welcome to the demo of the Virtual Performance Assessment Project. When students log into the assessment, they select an avatar that they want to represent them in the virtual world.
All right, I'll skip the rest of the video. I think you get a sense of what's involved. There's a couple ways in which this is different than the paper and pencil item-based tests. The first is that in a virtual world, we can evoke these inquiry skills in a way that is not possible with text. So students can be given a situation in which there's a lot of tacit things that they have to observe that would have to be made explicit in text. They can be given a much more complicated situation. We're not confusing measuring inquiry with their ability to read. And they're engaged. A lot of students who hate paper and pencil tests find virtual performance assessments engaging because they do have a kind of game-like quality to them. And they're more likely to care about actually trying to do well. But the other part of it, and this gets back into the analytics discussion, is that, of course, through virtual worlds, through augmented realities, and through any form of social media, we get these audit trails. And in the case of the virtual performance assessment, we get a very, very rich audit trail, way too much information to make sense of. It's effectively intellectually indigestible. And now what we're doing is wrestling with how we chunk and aggregate and filter this kind of information in order to construct a higher level description that a skilled teacher can make sense of. So the teacher might look at the pattern of student actions and say, okay, this is somebody that understands observations, but not inferences. This is someone who is creative about hypotheses, but doesn't know how to set up a controlled experiment, or whatever the pattern might be. So this is not taking kind of data that's generated across a very wide range of applications and applying machine pattern recognition to make sense of it, which is more what the analytics discussion was talking about yesterday. This is constructing an assessment that has been designed so that actions have meaning within a particular context and tend to be diagnostic about what students know and don't know. And then those are chunked in a way that a skilled human being can try to match what's going on to the different stages of inquiry. And then eventually, yes, when we understand how people recognize the appropriate patterns, we can try to look at ways to automate that so that a machine can follow in the footsteps of a human being and be effective at doing this. Now, I said that we were building a summative test, even though that isn't what we want to be doing. I'm old enough, unfortunately, to remember when stores closed for inventory. Do any of you remember that? You'd go to a store and there'd be a sign on the door that said, hey, sorry, we're closed for inventory, come back in 3 days. You never see that anymore because of the barcode reader. Other than shoplifting, stores know exactly what they have for inventory. And the same thing could be true in learning. So pre-college teachers are struggling with these horrendous high-stakes tests that aren't measuring the most important things that we're teaching, when instead, if we understood how to do this kind of assessment on a formative level so that it was interwoven with instruction and what you got out was diagnostic in real time for what to do next with the student, rather than doing kind of a pathology at the end of the year to see where you succeeded and where you failed, that would potentially be very powerful. We don't know how to do that yet. I'm not sure by the end of the project that we will even have a psychometrically fully valid virtual performance assessment that's summative. We're still grinding through that data. It's a difficult problem. But a lot of people are working on problems like this. And I'm optimistic that within a year or two, we're going to see virtual performance assessments that are psychometrically valid, that then start to move towards formative, so that we can look at the stream that's coming out of the EcoMove or that's coming out of EcoMobile and be able to draw some conclusions for these teachers about what students know and don't know, so that the middle school teacher might get an email every morning that would say, in your first period class, there are 6 students who are confused. Here's the students that we think are confused, and here's what we think they're confused about. Now, the teacher would then need to sort out whether that was accurate or not, because people are going to be better at this kind of diagnosis than machines. But it at least provides a start so that a teacher who's doing active learning with a class of 30 has a kind of help in order to be effective. So this is the one piece of what I'm describing that really isn't fully in place at this point. Now, this is not a new vision. Putting together virtual environments, social media, augmented realities, and virtual performance assessments as a kind of mix may be new, but the vision that underlies this, that students would, The vision that underlies this, that students would do active learning pre-college in a very rich way, is not a new one. And in fact, the whole history of educational technology shows that when we really get the pedagogy right, we're always astonished by what students can do. Elementary school students can, in fact, do middle school work. Middle school students can do, I think, a mixture of college and high school work, as college work is currently constituted. High school students who've come up through a system that gave them that kind of foundation in elementary and middle school, I believe, could do college-level work in the high school. So we are in a kind of a strange position, because we've gotten used to the products coming into college being worse and worse and worse. More and more students who are totally turned off to learning, as was described yesterday in the analytics session, more and more students who are broken and need lots of remediation, even though they've been certified as being ready for college. But I'm saying, if people like me who were really trying to make pre-college work can succeed, that situation is going to change very dramatically. And the National EdTech Plan, which is K-20, has an interesting diagram in it in which, yes, there is the classic classroom about 10:30, but the rest of the diagram is learning in other ways, outside of the class, outside of the campus, doing all sorts of things with different people, many knowledge sources beyond the students and the professor. So now I want to do the thought experiment. If this is where we go pre-college, and that really is attained within a reasonable period of time, 4 or 5 years, so that at least some significant proportion of students are coming to college this way, what should they learn when they reach higher education? And I've pondered on that, what some of these alternative visions might be. Of course, one of them would be more of the same. Deeper, richer, discipline-based instruction, more and more focus on higher-order thinking. If you will, if students come into college having done a lot of college-level work, maybe college should look like graduate school. But there's another way to think about it, which is to say, maybe we should just be intensely interdisciplinary, which is something that is not going to happen pre-college. And where we should focus is not doing the same kinds of things again within the disciplines, but instead really trying to build up students' systemic understanding of our natural and social world by interdisciplinary activities of kinds that now exist only in very small pockets and typically only for a very small fraction of students. Or there's another alternative that I want to spend a little time sketching that's kind of weird, and that is to say, instead of focusing more on knowledge, we should focus on wisdom. So I wrote an article, the same article where I talked about social media in Education Researcher, and I outlined a way that we could use social media to try to build up communities that would generate wisdom. And it was like dropping a stone down a well. So I'm not sure whether I'm being foolish about wisdom, which is, of course, an embarrassing kind of thing to do, or whether this is just a little bit ahead of its time. But if we look at the research on wisdom and pick not total wisdom, not exceptional wisdom, but kind of mid-level wisdom, there are different dimensions that are involved in it. And some of those dimensions are now stressed as part of the college experience. And others of those dimensions really are not. And wouldn't it be interesting if we worked in college not to just deepen knowledge, but to try to look at all the places that knowledge falls short in different ways and emphasize wisdom? And of course, I'm just picking three things that happen to come to my mind. You may have other things to put forward in your thought experiment, and these are not necessarily either or. We can imagine some kind of blended mix. The second part of the thought experiment is to say, how would this model that I've sketched with these four technologies apply to your academic field? And I would expect, if you look at it, that each of you would find that it applies to parts of your academic field. And you can do that part of the thought experiment much better than I can. I can describe the pedagogy that's involved, which is based on experiences that are understood by a community and that are measured in ways that don't involve tests and papers. But it's interesting to ask for different fields, what proportion of the things in your field that you think are truly important, both for citizens in the 21st century and for future practitioners in that field, could be taught now by combining these technologies plus whatever else you want to throw in out of places like the Horizon Report? I am certainly not holding this forward this thought experiment is the perfect pedagogy or something that works for everybody or the best way to think about emerging technologies. I just had a way to illustrate it with these videos to make it concrete for you. And I am, with my team, gathering some data that's suggestive that this seems to be really quite powerful, particularly in a lot of students who have been low-performing within the way that they've been taught, switching to being high-performing when they're offered learning opportunities that build on their strengths and their preferences. When I describe the thought experiment to publishers, I typically have an interesting experience because they say to me, wow, this is great. We're building these digital textbooks, and now, instead of just putting an image into the digital textbook, we could put a little virtual world, and students could wander around in the virtual world. We could have them do their homework assignment with little augmented realities that they could go out and experience. In addition to the nice multiple choice tests in the teacher's manuals, we could put in some little performance assessments to look for higher order skills. Now, the optical illusion that's on the screen shows two people, an older person and a younger person with her face turned away. What they're describing with the digital textbook is the older person. We know a lot about what that model of learning can and can't do, and how much it's likely to gain by sprinkling a frosting of active learning on the cake of presentational instruction. Not much. But what if the cake were the active learning? And what if the frosting were all of this presentational information that we have that now is rechunked so that whenever you're stuck, you've got something at your fingertips that gets you to the next stage of where you want to be. And then, perhaps towards the end, some kind of a synthesis that is deeper, that is more abstract, that the teacher brings in the interpretation and reflection mold to help you get the big picture, to help you be able to transfer. That's the young woman. Her face is turned away. We don't fully understand her. But I'm convinced that this is where we should be looking, both pre-college and in higher education. The last part of the thought experiment asks, what should we be doing to get ready for something like this? Should we be using these pedagogies ourselves? Should we be changing our expectations in a few years for who's going to be walking in to higher education and what they're going to know and what they're going to want? And I believe that in order to do that, we're going to have to do some things that we're very much not used to doing. One of the fundamental findings about professional development is that teachers teach as they're taught. If you're going to learn about using a virtual world, you're going to do it in a virtual world. If you're going to learn about augmented reality in your field, you're going to do it in an augmented reality for your field. We're going to have to bootstrap some of these methods of helping each other learn. And of course, it isn't the technology. This is not a talk about technology. This is a talk about a fundamental shift in content, pedagogy, and assessment that technology happens to catalyze. So getting people past the technology part of it into thinking about a fundamental change in how they do things and how we learn from each other at conferences like EDUCAUSE, but also now across distance, is really vital. The big problem, I'm convinced, is unlearning. We're all good at learning, but typically adults are terrible at unlearning. For example, through the efforts of a lot of public health professionals, I know that I should eat better. I should reduce the sources of stress in my life. I should get more sleep. I should exercise more. I don't do any of those things, but I understand the situation perfectly. There's not an intellectual shortfall that's involved. Unlearning is intellectual, emotional, and social. And it involves giving up things that have made us successful in order to adapt to a changing context. And I think it's going to be difficult to unlearn what we're doing now to make this big jump. But I also think it's essential to a bright future. Thank you very much. So we're happy to, I'm happy to hear your responses to the thought experiment. Are there some questions that have come in?
Yes, Chris, thank you. There, we do have some questions in from the IdeaScale space. First question runs, do you think that these technologies and approaches will be equal to the challenges facing higher education? Indeed, do you think that higher education is in crisis?
I do think that higher education is in crisis on a number of different dimensions. And I think that a lot of us are looking at the crises connected with failure. So we're looking at the crises connected with economic woes that are being unfairly visited on our heads. We're looking at the fact that students are coming in less and less well prepared because No Child Left Behind has created a situation in which kids are being educated to a very low common standard. But I think we have a different kind of crisis if instead we prepare for success. If we don't turn around pre-college education, we're in deep, deep trouble as a society. But if we do turn around pre-college education and higher education isn't ready, we're still going to be in deep trouble as a society. And one of the things that's going to be a crisis of success is going to be if we really do get to the levels that our national government is calling for in terms of the proportion of people who enter college, and places like the Gates Foundation are pouring in a lot of money to see that if they enter college, that they'll graduate from college, or at least that they'll come out with what they went in looking for. We don't have the capacity to handle that. And we're not going to create that capacity by building that much more bricks and mortar. We're going to need some kind of model, whether it's the model that I've sketched or some other variation on that model, where we can use a whole lot less bricks and mortar in conventional teaching in order to meet the crisis of capacity that comes out of success. So I think that we're better off looking at the challenges of success than the challenges of failure, even though it's the challenges of failure that we deal with every morning, day to day, right now. That's the technical problem, but it's not the strategic problem. Is there another question out of that group?
I very much like your goal of wisdom as being that which we should be doing in higher education. But here's my question. We know that in higher education there are cycles often linked to the economy as to what students feel they're coming to college to get. Back in the 1960s when studies were done, they wanted to become better, more learned, liberally educated people. And increasingly you look at those same studies and they want to get jobs. So as many institutions, even some of the best institutions, are increasingly creating programs that have a very clear vocational focus, how do you jive that quest for wisdom with what so many students are looking for?
It is a good question and a complicated situation, and we're dealing with a system in which we can influence only some of the parts. So that's always tricky because we're pushing on something that has different ways of pushing back. I think that students, if we get pre-college right, could graduate with a lot of skills that make them ready for mid-level employment. And maybe some of those students would choose to go on and just enter the workforce at that point and not feel that they had to go get a college degree in order to do things that now students with college degrees are graduating and taking those jobs. But I think we could offer students and employers an interesting kind of alternative, which would be to say, okay, you've got a baseline of knowledge, but it isn't just a knowledge-based economy, it's an innovation-based economy. And it isn't just applying knowledge that makes the world better. It's applying knowledge in a way that is, for lack of a better word, wise, although I think we'd have to find some synonyms for that. for employers. So I do think that there's a value proposition that we could offer that would speak to more of the dimensions of wisdom, being part of a college education, and having a kind of economic value associated with them, not in the narrow sense, but in the broad sense, that could be very important. But I am an optimist about that. And as I said, I wrote something about wisdom that just sort of vanished from the face of the earth. So I may just be off target.
If you think about success in that vision for higher education, where you're getting in students who can really perform as you're describing, how then does a faculty member's life change when they're trying to build something new as a learning experience in the way you're describing, compared to a typical faculty member's life now as they get ready for a typical class?
Well, I would hope that we as faculty would not spend most of our time building these things. I think a relatively small team of people like Amy could build some kind of virtual ecosystems that would scale all the way from elementary school up to graduate school in limnology and would be effective across that range. It would require a front-end investment. Individual faculty might want to edit them in different ways for certain purposes, but different versions of that world could be used in a very wide variety of courses and so would be relatively inexpensive when you amortize them across a very, very large number of students. I said that augmented realities are relatively easy to author, perhaps under the guidance of faculty members and teachers. A lot of our world around us could be augmented by students and then progressively re-augmented by us ourselves as we together evolve the augmented realities that are around us, annotating them, improving them, adding to them, and so on. So I think it's less about creating this infrastructure, although there would be a stage of bootstrapping. And it's more about going through this kind of a wrenching shift in our value proposition to students from being the expert sources of knowledge to instead modeling how you go through these apprenticeship-like experiences of making sense out of complexity in the case of science, and you can translate that into whatever would make sense from your perspective if you look at your field as an alternative. So I don't see this as somehow turning faculty into technology instructional designers, but I do see it, if we start to really take this seriously and work towards it, into faculty playing a different role that I personally find a more attractive role. It's a role I already attempt to play in my teaching, but I don't have the kind of power tools that we're describing here that would make it an easier path to walk. Well, it's 9:30. I will be around until 10. I hope you'll come and argue with me. I hope you found the thought experiment interesting. Thank you.
This podcast is sponsored by Moran Technology Consulting, providing management and IT consulting services to higher education institutions around the world. MoranTechnology.com. I'm Jerry Bain for EDUCAUSE. Thanks for listening.